listening to Podtrash's favorite Sunday morning program. Hello, everyone. Welcome to week 16 of Identity Rising. We are excited to be back with you guys again today. I'm John Wesley, your host, joined by my co-host, Mr. Chilbro Swaggins. Chilbro, how's it going?
I'm doing excellent, John. I woke up feeling like I was in a Johnny Cash song, but other than that, I'm unbelievably stoked for the show today. We have someone on the show that I've been reading for about 2 years now, I think. Interviewed him way back in the day when I first got a mic set up, had the whole crappy Skype recorder going. Just, in 2 years, a lot's changed. But it's someone that I've actually introduced you to, and I know that we've had a lot of discussions about his articles on past episodes. And that person is none other than Brett Stevens. And just a little bit about Brett. Brett Stevens is the founder of the website America.org. Now it's, for right now, it's America in Exile. He's also the founder of anus.com, which is American Nihilist Underground Society. He's the founder of, which branched into another subcategory of deathmetal.org. Also, another project was genocide.org. And the author of a great book that I've finished in a week. It was Nihilism, a Philosophy Based in Nothingness and Eternity. Brett Stevens writes on the topics of nihilism, deep ecology, nationalism, and anti-work. He opposes diversity in all its forms, including racism and anti-Semitism. Brett favors a society ruled by aristocrats, organized around hierarchy, oriented towards transcendental and realistic purpose, and ruled by culture, which requires extreme nationalism. Brett, it's an honor and a white privilege to have you on. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me on. It's always good to be on this podcast. I've had a great time in the past, and I'm looking forward to today.
Perfect. So I mentioned, I just want to get right into the question I want to ask you, because you wrote about it on America in Exile. But kind of superficially, I think, and I wanted to maybe get some more out of you. So I read all the articles you posted on American Exile about, you becoming the victim of leftist terrorism, everything related to, I believe his name's Tulio Bars or Bears, and, what sites have been he's taken down of yours, everything in between. From what I've gathered, and maybe you can expand on this, it seems to be a personal attack against you. I mean, there's a lot of other sites that I go on that seemingly be taken down before yours is taken down. I didn't consider Anus a site that was a hate site either. I wouldn't say this. I'd say the same thing about deathmetal.org. I was going through my bookmark list and I had six I picked out that could be considered more hateful than yours. And that was Occidental Descent, DavidDuke.com, Diversity Mocked Fry, National Vanguard, Radical Agenda, and Stuff Black People Don't Like. Do you have any thoughts on this? Why you?
Well, it's interesting because over the years, I've often been a target, both from the left and the right, and I think it's because I really annoy people. And the reason for that is in part what you put your finger on. It's not hateful. What I write is about common sense logic, about looking at the long term, about being realistic, and then finding the best that we can in life. And so it doesn't really fit into the neat boxes and categories that people would like. I don't think anyone is really threatened on the left by Hollywood Nazi sites, and I'm not claiming that any of the sites you mentioned are that. I'm saying that there's a whole lot of sites out there that have a much more explicit message, but the left enjoys them. And the reason they enjoy them is that they fit into the leftist narrative. They say, we're out here fighting the fascists, who are these hateful people who do the following things. And then they can point to a website where people are doing that, advocating for pointless genocide or other sorts of really emotional outpourings that aren't really policy. Instead, what I do is try to pick things out, look at nuance, and come up with arguments and policies that are workable, even if they're geared toward the long term. That is, they're not pragmatic. I'm not trying to work within the current system. I'm just saying, here are the truths, here's what we have to look at, and this is how we can maximize the situation and turn it around to our benefit and the benefit of people like us 10,000 years hence or longer. You know, if we're going to colonize the stars, we have to really think on a much longer time frame than we're accustomed to. And this annoys people. This upsets them because it steps outside of the narrative that they can easily handle. And it also shows a side of the right that I think is appealing to a lot of people who are in the middle or really politically apathetic. And they're just going, well, who has the answers? And when they find a sensible right-winger who's talking sensibly about nationalism as opposed to going over the top, it really sets them off. And that's why we were part of an attack that took down alt-right and amren.com, and I think also took down VDare for a little while. Now, those guys had been attacked in the recent past. Their hosting was up to the task. Ours was not. So we ended up getting attacked for longer, in part because the leftists involved needed a way to declare victory and go home. And I think that we have linked someone named Tulio Bars to the attack, but the real story here is that he has received about $40,000 in payments to fund this. So I think he's just the fall guy. And this is an organized leftist attempt to take down alt-right and related sites. And they're attacking us in part because deathmetal.org writes very condescendingly about left-wing music, mainly because most of it's terrible. I mean, there are some left-wing bands I really enjoy, like Napalm Death, for example, even though they're complete communists. But there's also a lot of really bad left-wing music, which, like the new Ghostbusters remake, you're supposed to buy just because you have a sense of guilt. So it's like, oh, well, I feel better for buying this. I'm doing the right thing. And we attacked that from deathmetal.org, and I've attacked similar things from america.org, and I think it actually got to them, and they took it personally, so they've made this attack almost personal. And that's why I think they picked us as opposed to those other sites. I mean, you named some great sites out there. I'll just add that some of those are insulated by the fact that if you're on WordPress.com or Blogspot.com, that's a giant hosting service that is pretty much impervious to any of this type of attack. So I think that's why they picked us, and I think that's why we'll see more attacks in the future. We actually threaten their narrative. A lot of other sites don't.
That's a really good point. So Tulio Bars is basically a public persona, though. You've said that he's not tried to hide who he is. So is he is in Baltimore, you said, like, people know who he is. So what's to prevent him from being attacked as well? Like, why isn't there any retribution?
I think it's not in the nature of the type of people who enjoy what we do to engage in retribution of that nature. We see this as unfortunate. It's like vandalism, basically. It's an extreme form of vandalism, sort of on the line between vandalism and terrorism, because the attempt is to censor. But I don't believe that our audience would see the utility in squashing one bug out of many, especially when you know that that bug is being funded by others. And really, I think that there's a paradigm shift here that you've put your finger on that's really important, which is that the media tends to tell us to focus on figureheads like George Soros. But the real problem here is that we have lots of people who are committed leftists, everyday people, and they're acting toward the interests of their group alone. And that group is leftism generally, overlapping with whatever ethnic, cultural, religious, racial groups they identify with. So the bigger problem is that we're trying to swat at heads of the Hydra here, swat at flies or cut heads of the Hydra. And there's many heads, and the neck really is the idea itself. So the type of person who enjoys what I write is most likely going to be like thinking along the lines of, we have to attack these ideas and we have to defeat these ideas, but we're not going to be able to do that by beating down people who are in the grips of these ideas. And in sort of a medical biological metaphor, we could see people who do things like this attack as simply infected with a bad idea. They may also be bad people. I have no idea. I don't know them. But when you see, you know, it's like a zombie movie. When you see people who are infected, what you really want to do is save the people who aren't infected and then find a way to defeat the infection if you can. But simply trying to shoot every zombie, if there's 200 million of them, is not an effective strategy, or it's at least a very slow one, if you know what I mean.
Exactly. That's a good, I appreciate the analogy there. So what's, for America.org, are you getting it back, or are you just going to be permanently shifting to American exile?
We are getting it back. The technical team I work with and I took the site off of our initial host after trying to combat the attack there. We have moved it to a new host, but there's some glitches there. We're currently on Amazon AWS, and it's got some major advantages and also some major problems, including that I think we're getting some negative pushback from Amazon, which may be content related because they haven't indicated anything else. And when people don't say things, you normally look toward what they're not saying as being a cause. But in the future, we're planning on upgrading to something faster. The sites are currently online, but I'd like to have them running at something more like their original speed. Our goal was mainly to mitigate the attack first, and second, to get the content back online. And now it's going to be to improve performance so people can enjoy what we're doing and we can expand operations, since obviously if enough of organized leftism thinks we're important to attack for a month, we're doing something right.
Chill, bro. I'd like to, Brad, once again, I appreciate you coming on the show, man. We've been looking forward to this. Matter of fact, when Chill Bro and I first started talking about people, guests who we would like to see come on, your name was in the mix from the beginning. And Chill Bro is actually the one that turned me on to America.org. I wasn't aware of it coming into this, but when I started reading your site, I think he can back me up. There was a lot of times most of the articles I posted for prep come from America.org. And Chilbro made a point, and that's kind of something I was going to bring up. Like, as far as your site compared to others, it kind of surprised me that you come under such a massive attack, being that, obviously we know they're going to go after the Daily Stormer and other sites like that, but your site was more of kind of like a V-Dare. It was kind of polished, not really what I would consider radical. But have you, like, as far as your personal self, have you experienced any attacks or people trying to dox you or anything like that, or has it just been going after your site?
Well, it's a long history because I've been writing for 20 plus years, and thank you for reading for at least some of that time. It's always great to have informed readers like yourself who take the material seriously because it's written with that in mind. As far as attacks, yes, I've experienced a number of personal attacks, luckily not on my person so far, though I wouldn't be, all that surprised if it happened.
Yeah,
I was doxxed in the late 90s, and it basically destroyed my life for a number of years. I've since that time had people frequently poking around trying to interfere with my personal life, calling people they think are my employers, calling people they think are me. There have been a number of failed doxing attempts where people have actually identified the wrong person and then harassed an innocent person. In one case, an innocent African-American person, which was more sad than hilarious, but also hilarious, to be honest. It's, you can't shoot and miss much more than that, I think.
Yeah.
But to answer the bigger question, I think what I do represents a threat. It is a studied, contemplative, quiet, and gentle-minded approach. I attempt to find solutions. I'm not interested in demonization. I'm not obsessed by cruelty or power. And the people who work with me tend to be the same way. We're just looking at how do we fix things. We approach this as your neighborhood handyman comes along the road and sees that Western civilization is dysfunctional. Well, how do we fix that with the least amount of inconvenience to anyone and then go back to living the good life of being the greatest civilization we can be? And that's my approach. And I think, the Daily Stormer is extremely well written. It's very persuasive. It's hysterically funny. I really enjoy Weave, and I've had some fun communications, interesting communications with Andrew Anglin as well. They're interesting people. They do a great job of what they do. At the same time, what I do is more threatening because I appeal to the upper half of the middle class who probably do have some power, some knowledge, and some form of competence that they've developed in their working life and personal life, that they're seeing echoes of that in what I'm doing.
Yeah.
We're speaking the same language. If someone runs his own business, his or her own business, I guess we should say, and then reads what I'm doing, that person is going to recognize similar patterns in what they've seen with people in real life. And I think that's what the threat is.
Right.
What America does is connect to people who are accustomed not just to being in the world, but to having to make decisions, but to have to make decisions in this world that require understanding of human psychology, of history, of the mechanics of power and management and administration. And so I think that is a bigger threat, because we're actually targeting the audience for National Public Radio, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New Republic, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, The Washington Post. People who read and consume that type of media are at home with what we do at America.org. Right. And I think that's why it provokes such extreme ire.
Yeah. Oh, I actually, for everybody listening, and for you, Brett, too, Chilbros actually was kicked off of Skype during this last question, and his internet went down. He's rebooting, and we're going to try to add him back on. But for the time being, Brett, and I'll say this, man, just like to give you a little personal backdrop on me. I actually write. I've been writing political commentary for about a year or two now. But I've always been interested in this kind of line of work, whether it be podcasting or writing or whatever, any kind of commentary. And now that we're on the dissident right, it's you know, it's almost like a big risk, and you have to really want it. You have to really believe in what you're talking about, because like you, I mean, we're at risk of being doxxed. I'm just a Joe Blow from, you know, South Carolina. I haven't hid that, but from South Carolina, I have a family and I work, and I actually had a situation a few months back where someone did dox me and sent an email to my employer, and I've done a pretty good job at hiding kind of my personal identity, but yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I want to ask you, you said you were doxxed in the 90s. Like, what were they accusing you of? Like, were they just the typical, like, you're evil racist, or was it something more specific that they were trying to label you as?
Well, this was in 1997, if memory serves. And so the internet was still new. And so what they had to do was point to my writings and say, look at this evil stuff that this guy has written. And then they'd quote some of the things where I said things that were controversial at that time, are slightly less controversial now, but still offend people, such as that I recognize differences between the races, right, sexes, and social classes. And all of that is highly offensive to people who are in the grips of egalitarianism. And for the left, it's not so much that what they describe you as, it's simply what they call a dog whistle. They're identifying you as being from the other side. You're not a moderate who will just go along with whatever the leftists want. You're not a leftist. Right. You're somebody who is, to use your word, a dissident. You have not agreed with them, and therefore you're a threat to them, because leftism is conjectural. It says life would be more utopian if we did these things. And that type of outlook is threatened if anyone is having a good life that doesn't involve using their ideology. Right. So if you're not part of their little ideological clique, and you're still doing something right and having a good life, having a good time, then they see you as competition, like another business competing with a business. It's like if I'm running a cake shop and I say, well, we make cakes for gays, so we're good, so you should buy cakes from us. And another cake shop is like, you know what, we just make cakes for people who are normal, and that we define that the following way, traditional values, that kind of thing. And that cake shop is doing just as well as the other cake shop. Then you can't say, well, our conjectural idea that we should, that everyone should bake cakes for gay people is not going to be proven. And therefore that threatens its presumption of authenticity and the idea that it's necessary. And I think that's what leftists are most afraid of.
Right.
If you interfere with the idea that leftism is necessary, they see you as a real threat. And so when I was attacked, all they had to do was basically say, hey, this guy's got some controversial bad opinions. And then that swarmed a whole group of people, some of whom were very well connected, to start spreading the word. And so it was quite a disaster. And they always start first by contacting your employer or someone they think is your employer. Then they start calling your friends. And then they just start spreading your name and information around until your life becomes really difficult. And it's a very, very nasty thing. And I have a great deal of sympathy for anyone who gets doxxed, even people on the left, because it is a life destroyer.
Yeah.
But because of the left being in power and them deciding that these actions are something that should be moral and acceptable, it's now become part of our political discourse. So it's a bit of a mess, and I'm sorry it happened to you.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't. It could have been a lot worse than what it was. The kind of advantage for me is that I live in a very small town, and most people, even within my employer and in the town and like officials, we all know each other, and I'm have family members, and that was an advantage for me. But I think if someone like you or Chilbro or whoever decides, hey, I want to write political commentary or I want to start a podcast, whether it's in the alt-right or whether it's some kind of, neo-Marxist stuff, you should have the right to separate your personal life from your political activism, so to speak. And people who try to do this, I think they take away that right. Obviously, there's a massive double standard. And I'll give you an example. I know a lot of us have faced censorship on Twitter. I don't know if you're have you had this problem?
Yes. Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh out loud, but yes, many of us have.
I was getting a bad feedback too from my mic. Let me turn my volume. But anyway, I pulled up some images, and I've got them saved to my computer. I was going through Twitter the other day, and I come across there's like this little teeny tiny community of people on Twitter. It's like they dress up like fur animals or something. It's like all little transgender guys or I don't know. It's just a bunch of weird shit. But anyway, one of the guys or the whatever he is was posting like his custom drawn anime or whatever. And it was like some of the most graphic, just nasty pictures of animated females showing their female genitals, and that was acceptable for them on Twitter. But I get kicked off of Twitter for 48 hours for tweeting out that race is real or something like that. Anyway, I know you only have a certain amount of time. Chilbro is back on. Do you want to get back in this, Chil?
Yeah. I don't know what happened. Skype sucks, as we all know. I don't know what happened. So, Brett, I have a question, and we kind of talked about a little bit beforehand. Generally, the alt-right is in a contraction period. I'm not too worried about it, but a lot of people are kind of suffering some of the blackpilling of like post-election malaise, thinking that we got Trump elected, that was the battle, and now realizing that actually it just started, and they're fearing doxing, they're feeling like public activism is dangerous and or worthless. What do you think is going on here? Is this a natural phase of a organization or a group that's kind of still new? What's going on here?
A lot of things are going on at once. The first thing is that there's a long tail on any ideological movement or change. And so most of the people who are interested in the alt-right are just now learning about it and figuring out what it is. And so I think the alt-right is actually growing and is rising in power. It's just not doing so publicly. And part of that is because we're having to change tactics. And we're leaving behind some of the bad baggage of white nationalism 1.0, which a lot of us suffered through. And just it was kind of appalling because it attracted a lot of antisocial people who did a lot of dysfunctional things. John just mentioned anime. Well, back in the day of white nationalism, there were a lot of guys who loved their weird, twisted anime. I mean, not the fun kind that's, normal and just cartoons, I guess, but, the sexual and demented stuff. And you'd find that all the time in white nationalism 1.0, because once you step outside of the mainstream, it does attract a lot of people who are, more interested in justifying their own behavior than finding really solutions to anything. So I think we're leaving behind white nationalism 1.0, which had a model that was designed to bring in as many warm bodies as possible, get them in organizations with interesting names and symbols, and then go out and do demonstrations which attracted media attention. Now, the problem with this was, in addition to the fact that it attracted antisocials of many types, including people who are pointlessly violent and cruel, it also brought about a model that's easy to defeat. Because once you set up an organization, it just takes one informer to leak the membership list or one informer to get on the staff and then do something illegal and create bad headlines. Or, even worse, it gets captured because that organization is then dependent on the leftist media for its recruiting. And so there becomes this weird, cozy little relationship where the Hollywood Nazi organization goes out, does something outrageous, the media reports on it, and everybody stays buddy-buddy, and in the meantime, actual goals are forgotten. So I think the alt-right is growing past that white nationalism 1.0 model. We're realizing that if we set up organizations and those do any kind of demonstration and anything happens there, which will be provoked by the left, the SPLC, ADL, ACLU, etc., are going to sue those organizations and bankrupt them, just like they did the Aryan Nations, and thus defeat them. So, to my mind, the alt-right is growing in strength because it is going back to being a cultural wave. That means it's informal. It's lots of independent blogs, podcasts, writers, groups, social groups, meaning people who just hang out, sort of like what you're doing and what I'm doing. We're just networking informally, and we're creating a change in mass perception, starting with the upper half of the middle class, that liberal democracy is not everything people think it is. Diversity is not everything people think it is. And we're not going to on a path to utopia. We're actually headed toward a Soviet Union-style collapse, or a Rome 2.0 collapse, as I call it. And so the more we spread that message and the more we hint about alternatives, so not so much to be coy, but in the sense of we don't know all the details, but we know roughly where we want to go, and we want people to sort of explore that on their own. The more we do that, I think the more power we gain. The left is going to try to measure us in terms of single organizations, like how well is the Daily Stormer doing? How well is altright.com doing? Both of those are important, obviously. When it's up, I'm a reader of altright.com religiously. You know, and I think the Daily Stormer is hilarious. But at the same time, the alt-right is not a figurehead. We're not a leftist-style organization with a single ideology and a single leader. Instead, we're a grassroots sort of movement, a wave. We are people who otherwise probably wouldn't be involved in this, except that we got involved in politics at all, except that we got concerned based on what we saw that was happening and how we analyzed the ideation behind it and the likely consequences of it. We're the type of people who read history and say, well, you know, anytime a society gets too organized and there's too much of a system, like in the French Revolution or under communism, things go badly, and here's why they go badly. And so we're trying to articulate those things, not so much in a sense of politics as in playing the game in Washington, D.C. and red team versus blue team, as much as in the sense of like, well, here's some ideas that people need to be thinking about for the future. And these give us a general idea of where we should be heading because, as you can see, the current time is a disaster and we like to make fun of it. And so I think the alt-right is not going to gain power in terms of figurehead organizations or leaders per se. What it is going to do is gain power as a cultural wave. At this point, if you want to be one of the cool kids, you're on the alt-right. The regime is the leftist regime that is currently ruling the West. And it's doing a terrible job, so we oppose it, and we're the rebels. And I think that's attracting people and bringing in new people who are not really interested in joining organizations and going to protests. They're interested in networking with others and then infiltrating organizations, much like the leftists once did, so that we can turn those organizations toward the values we have. So instead of having a flag, really, or a rallying point for everyone and then a giant mass of people run off and attack the Bastille, we have sort of a cultural movement which is subverting everything around it and gradually gaining power as more and more people come to see certain truths as evident. And I think that's more effective. So I think the alt-right is gaining in power. I think all the black pills are based on a media deception where they say, oh, we defeated this one organization or we defeated this one protest, therefore the alt-right is over. And you can tell that's true by looking at the headlines that came out after Charlottesville. I think all of that is deception. And instead, the alt-right is gaining power as what it really was designed to be, which is a cultural change in the West where people are starting to want to restore Western civilization instead of continuing to try to make liberal democracy, diversity, feminism, tolerance, pluralism, humanism, universalism, etc. work, because we know they don't work. They're paradoxical. They're just bad ideas. They infect people because they sound good. And then 50 years later, 250 years later, you find that they destroyed your civilization. So I'm going to say this is actually a year of white pills, in which we are finding that the alt-right is rising. It's just doing so invisibly. And in my mind, that's the best way for it to rise, because we're probably not at the point where we can have public organizations that aren't going to simply get mobbed by people with lots of money and time to destroy them. What we are going to do is create this network of people, this mesh of awakened and thoughtful individuals across the West who are interested in restoring Western civilization and are willing to avoid being politically correct in order to do so. And one proof of this that I'd offer is that you're seeing a lot less of the Hollywood Nazi stuff on the alt-right. And the left doesn't understand that we aren't Hollywood Nazis. We're a wide range of people with a wide range of ideas based around a certain conservative principle, one might say, based in the idea that societies are biological and civilizations are biological, and we need to preserve our racial, ethnic, and cultural roots in that. But, you know, we've transitioned from anything like white nationalism 1.0, and now we're heading toward this new way of doing things. And as this mesh, this network of people rises with this change in cultural identity and change in the way they see culture and the way they see our future, I think it's getting more powerful. And I think that's what scares the left, which is why you see them claiming that the alt-right is in decline.
That was, I mean, the point you made about diversity, I mean, obviously we know these things. And for the normies, and I use kind of my life experience. I bring it up all the time on this show. You know, I said before, I'm from a small town, and I kind of relate to this in a way where I have a family member who just had a really big aha moment where, you know, deep down inside they understand that race is real, and but the problem is they're an older individual, and so their news inflow comes from cable television, and so that's obviously Fox News or CNN or whatever. And so they, you can tell they're playing tug of war where they understand that diversity is not a strength. They understand that race is real and that it's part of our genetic makeup. But then they still have this inflow of garbage coming from the mainstream media. But we were talking this weekend, the town that I'm from in the 1950s and 60s, this your typical southern town, it was, you know, 80 or 90% white. And then slowly but surely white flight took place after the civil rights movement, and now the town is 75-80% black. Well, there's been a lot of problems over the last decade. The school superintendent is, there's a big uproar every 5 years, and a white lady was the school superintendent for a few years. She began to clean out the school system and get rid of employees that had no kind of certification. And they were, the blacks got upset about it. They held this massive protest. They had to pay her like $500,000 to buy her out of her contract and fired her. Then the black, a doctor, you know, a black woman came in, and now there's been a massive uproar with the whites, and they're going to fire her. So in this town of what they call diversity, it's just a constant battle, and everybody's at each other's throats. And I said, this is the product of diversity. You know, it's not a strength. It's a source of conflict. This town has been in shambles since the 1970s, and it's just a simple product of multiculturalism and diversity. And so what you said is absolutely right, and I do agree with you. This is a year of white pills. I think this younger generation is probably going to be the generation that changes the dynamics, and I'm excited to see the future.
I agree. And I think not only that, just speaking for Generation X, which is my generation, our generation was savaged by divorce and the disintegration of the family in real time. People who came after us sort of inherited that world and accepted it, but we saw things falling apart, and I think it took a huge toll. There's a lot of us now who are waking up too after spending 25 years basically in oblivion, dealing with personal problems, usually related, to be honest, to just bad family. Family problems, people, divorce, drug addiction, these sorts of things that I think savage families, and also just the sort of unstable mental state of modern people. And I think baby boomers were uniquely terrible parents. They were just, they would psychologically manipulate their children. And this, that basically imposes a 20 or 25 year penalty on getting to some kind of maturity about something like politics. And so I think Gen X is coming in. I think a lot of millennials are coming in too. I think they're realizing that they were the products of baby boomer indoctrination in the 90s, And once they've been out in the world and seen enough of these theories fail, they're starting to come over too. So I agree. I think there's white pills inbound in family-sized bottles, if you know what I mean. But, you know, there are two concepts here that are important to me that I thought I'd mention. And I say this because I grew up in a small town that had been absorbed by a large city that is 75% non-white and minority black. There aren't that many black people here relative to Asians, Mexicans, people from the Middle East, that sort of thing, Indians, Pakistanis, all of that. Most of what we see here is diversity failing in its raw form, because if you see a racial incident here, it's usually between two members of minority groups beating up on each other. Oftentimes, historically, it was black versus Mexican. And so you see how diversity creates constant internal conflict and how every group is basically fighting for the ability to determine its own future. They want to be in control because they know that other groups essentially would want the same thing and so would displace them. And this has given rise to two concepts in my head. And the first is Detroiting. This is named, of course, after Detroit. And that says essentially that once any place goes majority-minority, so goes the vote. And therefore, you're never really going to have anything other than a government dedicated to taking money from your white minority and spending it on benefits. And this puts the city or town or state or even nation into a death spiral where it's got a shrinking group of people it's trying to extract more money from, and it's dumping it on the others, which essentially eliminates the middle class and makes daily living more expensive because everything is taxed to hell and gone in order to subsidize the state. And as more places get Detroited, like I would say my hometown got Detroited, and I don't think it's because minorities are bad people. I think they're just voting in self-interest. But as these places get Detroited, you see them essentially get destroyed. For example, there was a huge flood here, and our government, our local government, instead of choosing to act on it and do something constructive, basically exacerbated the problem by emptying these reservoirs in the middle of the night and flooding most of the oldest areas of town. And this means that their tax intake at the end of the year is going to go down quite a bit because they've taken half of the value off a quarter of the houses in the city. So that's what Detroiting does. That's your death spiral. Government doesn't act on real problems. Instead, it spends money on benefits. And then when real problems do arise, it destroys the value base. And so there's less to tax and there's less money to redistribute. And so pretty soon the next stop is third world style living, which we're seeing now. So Detroiting is something that people need to be aware of because you're going to see it happening again and again. And it's a pattern, and it doesn't matter who the minority groups are. They can be African-American, they can be Hispanic, they can be mixed. They can even be, you know, the nice Asians, Japanese, Korean, Chinese, that sort of thing. They do the same thing because every group votes in its own interests. And the other thing I'd like to bring up, which is another concept that I think we should talk about on the alt-right more, is what I call wumping. And this is named after a book called The Wump World, which was written for children about a group of people who take their problems with them. They fly from planet to planet, and they create the same society there, and then it goes bad, so they flee off to another planet. And that's basically what we're doing in the West now. Everyone wants to move to a nice place and live apart from all of the disasters, all of the rot, the horror, the vandalism, the crime, the insincerity, the daily manipulation, the greed, the selfishness of modern society. But until you change your mental state, your outlook, and what you desire, you're simply going to recreate it everywhere you go. And so we're seeing that now here as people move in from California and New York, and they're like, wow, it's so great here. You can afford housing, taxes are low, et cetera, et cetera. But then they start demanding the same social programs that they did in those places. And that puts you into the Detroiting cycle, because once you start handing out social benefits, all of these people show up and it becomes diverse and it becomes third worldy, because a lot of them are basically impoverished on a permanent level, meaning that they lack the abilities to not be impoverished. And then your society goes into the same death spiral. And so when we criticize diversity, I think it's important to say things like that. And this relates to your experience in that I was reading some of Bill Faulkner's works the other day, because I really enjoy William Faulkner, and I think he wrote very convincingly about what happens to small southern towns when progress arrives. And he was talking about progress 1.0, which is people building factories and shopping malls and, you know, getting into city jobs and wearing suits and ties and that kind of thing. But progress 2.0, of course, is political. It involves diversity and civil rights and human rights and all of those things as a goal of society, not just as a method for having a healthy society, but the purpose of society itself. And when you see the destruction that diversity and other related programs commit against these towns, it becomes clear that these are things that are just bad ideas. And I think that's a big transition for the alt-right from white nationalism 1.0. And I think this is why we're winning. White nationalism 1.0 was basically saying, well, these black people ruined your city. The alt-right is saying, well, these ideas, diversity, feminism, equality, tolerance, pluralism, those ruined your city and your town, and they're going to destroy your civilization and destroy your descendants. And so this is an important transition for people because it gets us out of being mere haters, basically, merely people complaining about something that we see that is wrong, to people who are saying, we want to live in a thriving civilization, and these things are in our way. So I agree. I think there's white pills incoming aplenty as more people are starting to see that we're telling the truth on the dissident right, and the fact that we're suppressed suggests that we've hit some nerves, and that means we're on the trail of the truth. We might not be perfect, and we might not be fully there yet, but we're getting there while everyone else is running in the opposite direction.
Absolutely. One more thing I wanted to ask you, just because I know you're kind of on time constraint. There's a great meme out there, and I wanted to see if you thought it was accurate. The title, like the caption at the top says, when you just wanted to be left the fuck alone, but the commies wouldn't oblige. And it's the first picture is Ron Paul. He's fading into Hans Hermann Hoppe or Hoppe, and then he's faded into David Duke, and then David Duke's faded into Dr. William Pierce. And that's actually, it's funny, but it's also true because sometimes people think that there's a latent, quote, like hatred that exists in the West and that there's never a catalyst for things. So Trump being elected and all the, quote, you know, him allowing white nationalism or hatred to fester, it was always there, is what is their conclusion. I don't think you agree with that either. There's a catalyst. You created us. We just wanted to be left alone. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yes, I do, to a degree. I think that we on the right represent the natural way of living. We like the things that come out of nature, that are part of just being human, that are part of the human experience, that are fundamentally inner-focused. I mean, we are, your average rightist wants to improve himself, wants to become wiser, smarter, better, stronger, healthier, more moral. And that we view as the primary goal in life. So we're not interested in trying to use the external world and laws and welfare states or whatever to improve people because we know that can't be done. We're focused on setting up a sane, normal, stable society in which people can live fulfilling lives and get right with themselves, essentially. And I call this Mayberry. I mean, your average American white person and European white person wants to live in a small town or small city. They want to know their neighbors. They want to go to church. They want to be good people. And they want to focus on something resembling greatness, whatever it is, no matter how small. Even if you just run the smallest butcher shop in the world, you want to do it the best you can. Or even if you're a janitor, you want to do that the best you can, and you want to be part of a civilization that rewards you for having done your part. And so we just want normalcy. We want healthy life. But that requires Western civilization. And also, I mean, although we may want to be left alone, you know, world politics is what it is, especially since the days of the Mongols. We know that we're not going to be left alone. We have to be ready for others to interfere with us, and we have to be warlike and willing to repel them by whatever means are necessary and however much it takes. So normalcy is a complex thing, but it's basically what we want. We don't want an ideological quest to be a perfect utopia. We just want life as it arose under nature, and as we can improve it through things like civilization, learning, you know, cleanliness, these sorts of things. But we're not going to be left alone. And the most important part of what you're talking about, of that meme, I think, we're not going to be left alone from within. Mutations occur. People get neurotic. And any society is going to produce some people who are not winners according to that society. And they are going to work against it. And you either remove them, physical removal of some form, possibly an innocent form like exile, or they eventually overwhelm you. And I think what we're seeing in the West now is we're getting overwhelmed. So I agree. We just want a normal life, but the neurotics out there on the left and opposing groups, Muslims, Mongols, whoever, are not going to let us do that. So we have to be a little more militant about what we do.
John, are you there? Are you?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, I've absolutely enjoyed this. Wish we could have you for the whole show.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun. Had I been a little wiser, I would have scheduled more time for this.
Well, we appreciate it. Absolutely. We're going to go to break. We're going to take a few minutes of break, and then we will be back to talk about Donald Trump, Kim Jong-un, and the summit.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, man. Thank you.
Be good.
Guys, if you're just joining in, welcome to week 16 of Identity Rising. We have just finished up an explosive interview with Brett Stevens from formerly America.org. It's actually America in Exile now, which has been a victim of the notorious complaining and whining and bitching from the left, just from stating pure and simple truths. But thanks to Chilbro, we got Stevens on. Awesome interview, Chilbro. Appreciate you making that happen.
Yeah, if I could be like 1/10 as articulate as Brett, I will have made it in life. And yeah, that's what I've always appreciated about him. He isn't someone that says like I just did. He's just, it's just like the word just, it's like he knows this. He writes it all day. He lives it every day. So, you know, prepping for a 30, 45 minute interview is like, oh, I'll just wake up and do it and I'll have all these ideas that'll blow you away.
Yeah.
And he's supposed to be writing a book. He wrote Nihilism. I read that one. It's completely different from what you would think it would be. He takes a different take on what he considers what nihilism is.
Yeah.
Separating it from nihilism versus fatalism. Fatalism is just, hey, everything sucks and you die, and that's my philosophy. Is it don't do anything positive because in the end we're all just, you know, dust in the wind sort of thing.
Right.
He views nihilism as extremely realistic point of view, but that's getting off topic. He should be writing another book soon called like Parallelism, which
yeah,
should be interesting.
What you posted, it's been a while ago when you were running your YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. You posted a video of a guy on YouTube. I think this was like an English guy. He's an older guy. It was an older video. And you was like, I wish I could elaborate points and topics like this guy. I mean, this guy was just like the smoothest, off the hip, like speech I'd ever seen, and it was somebody that you inspired to be more like during your podcast.
I can't believe you remember that. Yeah, it's Jonathan Bowden.
Yeah, Jonathan Bowden. Well, the reason I remembered that is because last night I have been listening to one of Evola's audiobooks on YouTube, and I'm almost about 75% through it. And one of the related videos or suggested videos was Bowden, and he was actually giving a speech on Julius Evola. And to be honest with you, the setting that he was in, where he was at standing up, it looked like the exact setting of the video you posted. So I know that's been a while back when you posted that, but I remember somebody that I know was talking about, you know, inspiring to be able to talk off of the hip like this guy does, and I remembered
yes,
it was you.
That's so funny, because it's like an hour-long speech where he doesn't have any notes, and he's just talking about Julius Evola and how radical he is and understanding yeah, him so well. And he talks about, I don't know if it's in that video, but he talks about his speech patterns
yeah,
and how the words come to him right as he's saying it. So it's like he doesn't see the words. He doesn't have like a programmed script in his head.
Yeah.
He just, as he's speaking them, as his tongue and lips are forming the words, it pops in his head. So it's like free thought, but it always comes out amazingly. And the shitty thing about him is that he died so young. He wrote a couple books. I read one of his books called Western Civilization Bites Back.
Yeah.
It's a great book. It's on Countercurrent sells it. They sell all his litany of books. But he had all these great interviews, and he died like in 60 or something. So
yeah,
he was one of the – I think even Brett Stevens considers him like one of the best speakers ever on the right.
Yeah.
A lot of British politics, obviously, he's a Brit. But yeah, I appreciate you remembering that because if I can be anywhere near those guys in terms of articulating how I feel about things,
yeah,
I'll just retire at that point.
Well, I mean, I obviously, and people that listen to the show, I mean, I bog myself down all the time, and I have certain things on my mind. I think I'm more like someone that I know personally said that my mind never sleeps because I just think about things constantly, and I multitask in a mental state. But anyway, yeah, it's been a really good first half. I would say let's dive into the political happenings mm-hmm, of the week. We've been in a kind of a metapolitical intellectual conversation. I feel like I'm like 100 times smarter now listening to Brett Stevens talk. I don't feel like such a redneck or something from the South. Nah, Donald Trump arrives in Singapore. Fox News is reporting that Air Force One has landed, and this was tweeted out about 2 hours ago. And it says, Actually, this, what I'm reading, it says Fox and Friends host slips. Trump's North Korea summit is a historic meeting between two dictators. And some host on Fox and Friends accidentally said this, but I'm sure this individual probably thinks it. Before we really get into this, I want to bring, just like make a comment really quick on this. I saw someone, you know, when I was in my normie Republican kind of mindset 6 or 7 years ago, I used to think Fox News was like the Patriots, you know, like they were right-wing Patriots, Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly. And I saw an interesting quote the other day that said the reason that the left looks at Fox News as being far right is because mainstream media is so far left, and that actually Fox News is more centrist than anything. I mean, we know liberals and neocons occupy the airwaves on Fox News, but I don't know. I've just had this, and I wrote an article this week about kind of the difference between metapolitical argument and political argument. I think a lot of normies, including people that I know personally, they don't really understand that culture directly affects politics. I think they have this warped sense of if you vote for the person that they believe will change things, that it's going, that the politics is going to change the culture. Whereas we see that culture is, or politics is downstream to culture, and so culture directly affects politics. And a lot of normies don't really engage in metapolitical dialogue. They don't understand what we do. So I don't know. For some reason this week, I've kind of had these little like light switches turning on, and I'm understanding things a lot better. Whereas a year or 2 years ago, you know, it's, I reckon, my personal political evolution. Do you still have those moments where, like, you can actually like understand your opinions are changing based on information flow?
Yeah, and it takes a couple different sources. So I'll see it one time on a website. I'll like store it somewhere, and then I'll see a video, and the puzzle will kind of fit together. And then I'll observe it in my personal life, and I'll go, okay, now I've seen it from three different mediums: personal life, a video, I read it, and now I'll make the switch.
Right.
It's almost the same thing as being sold a product. You have one person tell you, you're like, okay, you're just one person, but then you see an advertisement, then you see someone else using it, and it's the same thing with any sort of change. Is you're worried about it at first because it will challenge someone. The easy beliefs that are, you know, fun, and as Brett called them, it's a path of least resistance to believe that whatever leftists want you to believe, requires no sort of thought or struggle, and that's sort of how I've made all my changes. But it happens all the time. Once I think I'm completely set in my ways, I'm like, all right, now I know what I believe. Something inevitably happens. Then I'm like, well, now I got to re-question this, like my thoughts on immigration or thoughts on the JQ or thoughts on something. Yeah. And he talked about how conservatives are always on this path of growing or doing better, being more moral, learning more history, digging deep into something. Yeah. And that's why you have, when you kind of get involved in this movement, you're so surprised at how many amazing minds are out there.
Yeah.
And it inspires you to do better and be like, when I hear Brett talk, I want to be a better speaker. I want to be more educated. I want to listen to better music. And that's a whole nother topic of music. I honestly think music is an intellectual endeavor.
Yeah.
And when people listen to, like, if you played Xerius all day, you would go mentally insane.
Yeah.
Because it's just that repeating the same note over and over can drive you insane. It's good for the show because it's high energy, but I don't know where I'm going with this, but Brett talks a lot about in his book, Nihilism, that music should only be something that moves you at all times. So either it moves you to sadness or crying, or moves you to joy, or get that little tingle feeling when you hear like the first time you hear Tears Like Diamonds, you're like, damn, this song just, what was I doing before I heard this song? You know?
Yeah.
Those kind of things intellectually are I experience them all the time.
Right. Well, I mean, to be honest, since we've been doing this show, I try not to be like, you know, obviously it's very easy to slip into the notorious echo chamber, and I try not to regurgitate what I'm hearing from, you know, the things that I listen to, the Fashion Nations or the Daily Shores or whatever. I try to, like, come to these conclusions on my own, but because of our personal evolutions, obviously I'm further behind than, say, other people who are on this kind of, like Brett Stevens said, he's been doing this for 20 years. I mean, obviously, I'm just figuring things out or deciding on certain things that he's been thinking for years. And it's kind of like when I do have those light bulb moments, I want to elaborate on them. I want to talk about them. And I'll be honest with you, I said a year ago that the hardest red pill for me to swallow was admitting that Jewish influence is absolutely real and very dangerous and destructive for Western civilization. But now, a year later, that, I mean, the reason I said it was a hard one to swallow is because of my religious upbringing. But now I see that my opinions changing on democracy and capitalism and the Constitution, to me, that was harder to swallow than the JQ. And the reason, I mean, I've said this before, it's going to have to take some form of fascism to change the trajectories for our country and for really the West as a whole. I mean, you know, you can say, well, National Socialism or fascism or whatever. I think National Socialism has some good parts of it. I think there was parts that failed, but it's capitalism, democracy, and free markets is absolutely the cause of a lot of our problems. And just by me uttering that statement would turn off a lot of so-called patriots, you know, the Trumpian Republicans. But anyway, yeah, I think it's interesting. Mm-hmm. Personal political evolution is very interesting.
Yeah, and we can, I think this is a good transition here, because Brett had mentioned being conservative or like viewing things for like not how we want them to be or projecting our own wants onto the political realm. We go, well, what makes the most sense based off historical wins for Western civilization? And this coincides with Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un is something that just needs to be done. It's been pushed off for way too long.
Yeah.
It is objectively the right thing to do. People that don't understand the art of the deal and how Trump does things, obviously, it's pretty simple. And there's a Daily Stormer article on it that I posted, but he talks about how people are bitching left and right that Kim Jong is not going to disarm. Well, Trump knows he's not going to disarm. It's just a negotiating tactic.
Right.
So, okay, if you're not going to disarm, at least let us, you know, build some McDonald's or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it would be ridiculous to assume that Kim Jong would give up all his protection at just our word, because then you will get Libya modeled and we will come and destroy you just because that's what the neocon Zionist shills want. So he's going to go, all right, Kim, you know what? If you're not going to disarm, how about we just build a Trump hotel there and we'll call it even? Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's kind of how Trump works, and the media is so dumb. And they're so short-sighted that they never see the long play of anything.
Right. So are we looking at a 4D chess moment? I mean, is this something – because obviously the John Boltons, you know, we know no matter what happens, you've got these neocons that want some kind of, you know, military strike or some kind of conflict with North Korea. They've been itching at the belt for decades. But do you think that – I mean, I thought about it this morning. I honestly think Donald Trump, he knows that if he can find some kind of way to achieve, I don't think we're going to ever see denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, but I think he understands. I mean, you had a host on CNN, I think it was Aaron, CNN host said that he deserves the Nobel Peace Prize if he can achieve this, and I think Donald Trump finds this very, very important to make it happen. I mean, do you think it's a 4D chess moment, or do you think he's going to be influenced by these neocons?
No, it's not 4D chess. It's how he's negotiated forever. It's to them, it's new because he's not following the political script and strategy that's been written for him, and it's been written for all the, you know, last 20 years, 30 years for presidents. He's just doing what Trump always does, where he says something insensitive on purpose to get people distracted while he gets something done.
Right.
So, for example, this whole thing where he was at the G7 summit and he showed up late to the gender equality breakfast. Like, he showed up 17 minutes late and caused a huge hubbub because, like, the press, someone was speaking and the press turned all their cameras towards him, and he had this huge mob come in, and he kind of sat next to some lady that gave him like the funniest like face ever. Her name was Christine Lagarde. And people kvetch about this, and they're like, how insensitive. And you have Kathy Griffin showing him, like, Trump showing up late to a breakfast on Power Net Women. Like, what an asshole. Like, we were supposed to be the moral authority in the world, and this is all part of him distract while he fixes tariffs on the 270% markup that we're getting on dairy from Canada.
Right. So, and Justin Trudeau opening his mouth, which, to be honest with you, women have no place at a G7 summit to begin with. The women should be at home taking care of the children. And I mean, my wife agrees with that statement. And a lot of trad wives or traditional women would agree with that statement. Women have no... It's like anything that you let women get involved in when it comes to politics, I hope I don't turn anybody off by saying this, but they fuck it up. I mean, you know, women are not equipped mentally to handle these stressful situations. And I'm sure if the right leftist hears this, I'll be put at the top of the radar. But there shouldn't be a fucking gender equality summit going on at a G7. Conference or whatever you call it.
You're right. No, 100%. You're basically pretty much saying what Andrew Anglin was saying today, which was that when we start to focus on stupid things like, you know, we have these massive government organization or summits, and they focus on things that no one cares about. Zero. Like, there's no interest in equality thing, and I'm not even sure why Trump would even be invited or want to sit at a gender equality thing. It's either just a massive troll campaign, or they wanted Trump to look bad because they knew that he would be out of place there.
Right.
There's two. I don't know what to think about it. I think maybe it's, did he choose to go to this meeting? Like, what, did he even have any remarks? Like,
I'm sure he was guided there by some, maybe by Sarah Sanders or Kelly Conway or someone like that guided him there. I don't foresee Trump, like, he would probably think that was a waste of time. I mean, you're at a conference, at a meeting of the world's like greatest powers. I mean, you're not at a freaking Mary Kay conference or something. This is the G7 summit. What in the hell would there be a gender equality breakfast? I mean, I don't know, man. That's me.
You're 100% correct. And the one thing I almost forgot to mention was before he started calling Trudeau a pussy, and how he basically did, because he's like, Trudeau acted very meek and mild and we're going to fix this. And
he's a pussy.
He is a huge pussy. But the thing that really rustled some Jimmies or rattled some Jeremies, however you want to say it, is he said that Russia should be back in the G7. And he said, like, hey, maybe you don't agree with Russia, but when we're talking trade and world powers, yeah, maybe we should include Russia, you fucks.
Yeah.
And that really turned some people off.
So didn't it used to be the G8 summit? Mm-hmm. Wasn't it G8 and then now it's G7 because of the lack of Russia? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I've put a lot of thought into this whole ordeal with Trump for months now. And I've voiced my concerns for Trump, but I just, you know, I think a lot of the things that we disagree with him on are things that he's been kind of coached to do by the people that we despise. The John Boltons, not necessarily saying that Bolton has his ear. I'm just saying these neocons, and even I think there are most likely some liberals, political liberals in his administration. And they're constantly coaching him on these things. I just hope Trump is himself. In the next few days, I hope he will try to achieve the ultimate deal, which I think would probably be the greatest deal achieved in his lifetime. And if this And I know there's been a lot of conversations about Kim Jong-un and, you know, North Korea does this every, like there's a cycle where they do this, they meet, you know, his father met with Bill Clinton, and there's some sort of false peace in that region for a few years, and then it escalates, and then we get to the point where they're doing new missile tests, and then we repeat the cycle every, you know, 7 to 10 years, and they end up getting aid and money, and it's just a way for them to stay relevant. But I hope this time that Kim Jong-un understands that this is probably his last chance. I mean, Barack Obama's not in the White House anymore. We have someone who actually will hold his feet to the fire, so to speak.
Well, and there's so many things that this summit is destroying, so many narratives. There's all these side narratives too. So there was a Zero Hedge article came out, I think it was on Monday or Tuesday, that was about Trump considering firing John Bolton. And this had been something that people had talked about happening, where they hire John Bolton to appease the Zionists, as you know, as he's the guardian of Zion and winner, and let him do the Syria strike, but then blame him for a failure. Now, his failure is going to be, it was almost when he talked about the Libya model as the model for North Korea. Now, Trump could have been, hey, you fucked it up, you're out, and he gives him his out to fire John Bolton, but also at the same time, save face, but like, hey, I hired him, but he didn't do the job right. He ruined the summit. What am I going to do? Like, I'm just going to fire you. Yeah. But I still think John Bolton's on his way out, and it's going to be after the summit. And the summit, dude, it's on Tuesday. Like, I'm stoked. So I'm going to make this prediction, Chilbro prediction, that by the end of the week, John Bolton's gone. If the summit goes well, he's got, well, good or bad, doesn't matter. John Bolton's gone, and they'll bring someone else in.
Yeah.
And there's been some mumblings about who it might be, but either way, I think he might be gone. And if it happens, then we'll be proving that all this QAnon stuff is correct. And Trump's just, you gotta work with the process. Just trust that he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, this is gonna kind of take us. We're gonna route off just a second. Since you and I talked about this QAnon stuff, and I had a conversation with someone else about it, about like all of these crazy things coming, you know, they've actually happened after they've been predicted. Excuse me. I ran into a video last night, and I was actually, like, I try to get, I try to go to sleep at the same time every night, so I can, like, I like to keep a routine, but I ran across this video last night, and I ended up crashing that routine. I was up several hours later. Have you heard about the Tom Delaney from Blink-182 thing that's going on with the UFOs and all this stuff? Have you seen anything about this?
No, but I know who the guy is.
Okay, well, I'm telling you, I know this sounds kind of quirky or whatever, but when we finish the show today, you need to look it up. So, basically, and I had seen Tom DeLonge with Joe Rogan, like, I didn't watch the podcast, but I seen him on with Joe Rogan this past week, and then I kept seeing his name pop up. And, I mean, back in the 90s, I loved Blink-182. I saw his name with the UFO Summit, and obviously, you know, that kind of little flags. But anyway, I watched it, and I had to really dig deep to understand what was going on, because it was confusing to me where Tom Delaney with Blink-182 was standing on stage with members of the DOD, of the NSA, the CIA, high military officials. There was this conference he did, and there was 7 men sitting behind him, and every single one of these men were former members of these, like, the intel community, and all. I mean, it was just crazy. So here's what's happening. Tom Delaney has had this lifelong interest in like UFOs and futuristic technologies that we don't know about, and like these like airplane looking things that can travel through time. I don't know, just craziness. Well, anyway, after Blink-182 kind of crashed, because they came back with a reunion in like 2012 and then it crashed, Tom Delaney has been meeting with these officials for like 5 years, and he's created this company called Reach for the Stars. And the purpose of this company is to create content with, it's kind of confusing, but basically science fiction content, fictional books. And basically, he was introduced to these reps from Lockheed Martin and given like this crazy access to some technology that like the public doesn't know. And I kept asking myself, like, why Tom DeLonge from Blink 182? It didn't even make sense. So I watched Mouthy Buddha done a whole video on this, and this is the video that kept me up late. And basically says either the government is ready to tell the public some things that we've never been told, and they're using Tom DeLonge as a front man because he's, you know, known for Blink 182 and like a rock and roll guy or whatever, or they're using him such as a guy back from the 90s, and I can't remember his name, but it was a scientist who had retired. He lived in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he had equipment where he could listen to radio activity from these military bases, and he ended up picking up on some information from a military base in Albuquerque, and he found out some things that he shouldn't have known. And basically, the government acted like they were going to let him be involved with this and made him believe some false things, and it drove him crazy, and he ended up dying in a mental institution. I know this whole thing's crazy. It's like, what's the point? But I'm getting to it. So Tom DeLonge has this company. The government has given him access to all of these things, and supposedly next week, he's holding a press conference with the members from the DOD, the NSA, and CIA, and they're going to tell us something that the United States discovered 10 years ago that we've never known. Now, I don't know what's to think of it. I don't know what's going to happen, but I can tell you right now, if you start really watching it and looking at what's going on with this, especially with the government, it's a very eerie and very interesting thing. You need to look it up. It's crazy.
No, I'm totally into that stuff. I just didn't see. I probably should have ventured out a little bit more on the news sites.
Yeah.
About that stuff. I've read like two David Icke books. I've read.
Oh yeah.
Well, what's the guy called? I always forget his name, but he wrote a book called Behold the Pale Horse.
Yes.
Which is
I know what you're talking all
about. Secret documents of, you know, underground bases where aliens are fighting the government, and just futuristic technology that whatever we think, whatever we could fathom, has already been made. So anything in science fiction movie is already 20 years behind what's actually going on. I was just had a conversation with a bunch of people about alien encounters they've had in their life that they're totally normal, same people. I swear I saw this. This thing flew over my head, and it had like in the pictures that you see online of the description of what he saw was exactly that.
Yeah.
I'm totally a believer in it. And I want this revelation sounds super interesting, and I hope
it
doesn't turn out to be a dud.
It's crazy. If you'll look in the, like in our prepping, server in the links, a really good friend of ours that listens to every single show, who is a fellow AFA brother of mine, posted this article and sent me a message and said this would be awesome to discuss. And if you'll look at it, it's the title is Iceland's Official World Cup Video Blasted for Aryan White Power Influence. Hey, look at this link, and there's a video with it. Basically, let me see. Hold on. So it's on mirror.com.uk, and it says Iceland's official World Cup 2018 video blasted for Aryan white power imagery showing players as inhuman barbarians. And this is coming from Iceland. And I'm looking at the video, and it's crazy. Their soccer team is like this animated Viking with shields, and there's runes in it. It's awesome. Do you remember the story last year with what was it? The ski team.
Yeah,
and they had the Tyr rune and Alge's rune on their uniforms, and the mainstream media blasted them saying that they had, you know, Third Reich imagery on their uniforms, when in reality it has nothing to do with the Third Reich. But anyway, this I'm gonna have to watch this little commercial because it looks badass. It's got like their soccer team. They look like a bunch of like brave Vikings with shields and runes all over everything. So it's they're beautiful. Being blasted for Aryan imagery. You know, we can't celebrate our culture and our heritage and our traditions. We have to lay down like dying dogs and celebrate Black Lives Matter and gender equality conferences and breakfasts and stuff.
This is that toxic masculinity, John.
Yep. Toxic.
Any guys that are flexing, looking angry, having beards, having any sort of muscle, looking like they may hurt somebody or could possibly hurt somebody,
yeah,
is off limits. But all these guys are so fucking beautiful. And the thing about Iceland, as I understand it, it's obviously very isolated, and there's not really, in the political world, they're not relevant at all to anything, really. So there's going to be this article, but they're smart enough to know, okay, yeah, article, and then they'll forget about the next week, and you know, the video will stay up, the imagery will stay the same, which is good. They know they're not going to freak out and back away, because I'm pretty sure Iceland's, as far as I know, an ethno-state of sorts.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the same thing as Norway, Sweden, Denmark. I mean, obviously, these places are known to be super progressive and liberal, but I heard, I want to say it was one of our alt-light guys, maybe McInnes or something. Anyway, they were interviewing... Yeah, it was Gavin McInnes. He was interviewing some woman, like a feminist SJW, and she was saying that the United States needed to be more like the parts of Europe, like Scandinavia, the Icelands and Denmarks and stuff. And she was talking about socialized healthcare. And the more socialist policies of that part of Europe. And Gavin McInnes called her and was like, well, why do you think it's that way? I mean, you know, these places are basically ethno states. They're 90% to 95% white. There's no real diversity. I saw a video with a real famous folk song from Ireland, and the whole town of Dublin got together and they made a video with like all the kids and people in the town singing the song, and I saw like three black guys, and I'm sure they felt like they're like on the forefront, you know, right up with the U.S. with diversity. But when you look at these places that are predominantly white, I'm sure when you see a black guy come to Ireland and he's living there, you probably feel like things are changing. There was one thing I wanted to bring up before we come to a close. I know this episode was kind of built around Brett Stevens. By the way, and I think this is appropriate to say on the show, Chill Bro, I have sent out emails to a few people asking would they be interested coming on our show. I sent out emails to Richard Spencer. I sent an email to David Duke. I sent an email to... what's the guy that does the political cesspool podcast? You know what I'm talking about? The bald-headed guy. Him and Richard's done some interviews together. He's like a David Duke protege. I can't think of his name. Chillbro, are you still on? Okay, so Chillbro's been kicked off again from Skype. Let's see what is going on. Because I can hear the sound changes when this happens. Let me see if I can add him back to the call. I know he was having internet problems a minute ago. Hey, I have you back on?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can hear like a fuzz when you're on, which is fine. I mean, it's like not really noticeable, but then all of a sudden it got real quiet, and I was like, damn, he's gone again. You must be having internet problems.
My Obama internet sucks.
What was the last thing you heard me say?
You were saying, oh, the political cesspool, and then I was about to answer, and then it just cut off.
Yeah, what's that guy's name?
I don't know. I have no idea who it is. I know of the show, though.
Yeah, he's a he's a bald-headed guy. He's been in this for a long time. He's done interviews with Duke and Spencer. Anyway, I just sent out emails to several of those guys, not saying that we you know, endorse any specific thing. We just, like, our goals is to get more high quality people on. And Brett Stevens and Stephen McNellan and Patrick Casey, I'm very proud of these episodes. I'm very proud that Chilbro and I have worked together hard to make this happen. And we have personal lives, we have jobs, we have responsibilities and obligations, but we still give you guys a solid hour and a half. Hopefully I'll hear back. I will tell you this, Chilbro, and then we'll close out on whatever you want to. So since last week when Stephen McNellan was on, which was a powerful interview, I've been thinking about last week for several days now. Stephen McNellan and I have talked since, and we're going to try to organize something over here on my side of the country with the VOTEN network, where he does these VOTEN on the Peak projects, where they find a mountain or some sort of elevated area. They get a big group and they hike. When they get to the peak of wherever they're at, they raise a horn to our ancestors and to the gods or whatever. And you don't necessarily have to be a pagan to do this. I mean, this is kind of honoring our ancestry, you know, honoring our traditions. And so I'm very excited about that. I want to, work with Stephen and try to make some things happen over here. But is there anything else you want to hit on? We've got 4 minutes.
He lives an hour from where I'm at. So we're going to do some things as well. Maybe have a meetup at his place. I know that he's a little bit, I don't think he has a cell phone, so it's a little bit harder to get in contact with him, but I'm going to make it happen. He's a good guy, he's a good ally to have. I don't really have much to say. I think I can't add anything ever to what Brett says because it just covers so much and is so much more intellectual than what I could ever produce. But we're only in, episode 17? What is this one?
16. Week 16. And look what we've accomplished in 16 weeks.
And if people don't get back to you, it's not a big deal. There's so many great people. I mean, like, most people don't know Brett Stevens, but I would put him on the same intellectual level as anybody on the alt-right.
Absolutely.
So it doesn't necessarily have to be a figurehead. I would really like to get Mike Enoch on.
Yes.
He's kind of like he's my favorite figure, and he's not trying to brand himself like Spencer has or is or whatever.
Right.
He's just sort of being the guy that he is and not trying to be like, well, if I go on that show, it's going to look bad at my agent. And that's not Mike. So we should try and get him on.
The thing about, and like with the Dukes and Spencer and the guy from Political Cesspool, obviously they're public figures. So they have like, contact information where you can email them or whatever for media requests. But Richard Spencer, it obviously for me personally was the catalyst for me kind of coming into the alt-right. He was the first person I discovered. But there's been a lot of things Spencer's done that I disagree with. I mean, obviously the Michigan event where they were side by side with the cringy NS guys. I think it would be healthy for the show to even get people on that we completely disagree with. I mean, I still support Richard Spencer, but there are things that I disagree with, and I would call him on those things. But I would love to see some blood sport type things go on where we get some people on the complete opposite side of the aisle, and maybe have some sort of debates. I think that would be healthy. But anyway, Brett Stevens, I am glad you turned me on to him because, I mean, the guy's writing is just it's phenomenal. I mean, it's absolutely phenomenal, and I hope that he will be able to get things back going the way it was with America.org. My wife messaged me. She listens in to the show. She goes and visits family on Sundays while we're doing the show, and she messaged me and said that I need to drink some water because I sound like Alex Jones. So I think it's a good time to I think it's a good time to go ahead and end here. But anyway, Chilbro, good show, man. Week 16. We will be back next week at the same time as always, and we'll see you guys on the next one. That is written.
time we're probably all wrong. Stop playing along. A single Jew was burned to ashes, to residue. Deadly gases, look to report. Just watch him prove it, it's Jewish lore. That will affect to it. Jews are just a brain, no common sense though. They think you can burn, so nothing's left there. Ashes don't just fly away in thin air. Nothing's left behind, not even one bone. Starting Jews, they pump supply routes. Got typhus too. Had to be deloused, a barter chip to take Palestine. But I'm sure that it's really in your mind. Why was there a pool in an Auschwitz? Soccer teams and beer, theater and brothel. If your goal is death, why even bother? People still believe this wartime rumor.